Hello, I'm Jyothi Patel, professor of medicine and the director of thoracic oncology at the University of Chicago, here in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome to Medscape Oncology Insights, coming to you from the 2017 annual meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. As oncologists, we develop personalized therapies for our patients. We use diverse treatment plans to treat a diverse disease. We recognize that patients come from diverse backgrounds and are in unique circumstances, and we adapt our health system to effectively treat their cancer and to improve outcomes. We at ASCO contend that ethnic and racial diversity among oncologists improves the health of our profession and the care of our patients. In a statement issued in May, ASCO reported that African Americans and Hispanics are underrepresented in our profession, and this significantly impacts the health of our nation. Here to talk with me are two oncologists who helped develop ASCO's statement about workforce diversity. All three of us worked over the past several years on this, but we want to address why this effort is needed and why our profession needs real tools and a concerted effort to move this forward. Dr. Karen Wingfield is Associate Professor of Radiation Oncology at the Wake Forest Baptist Health Comprehensive Cancer Center in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And Gladys Rodriguez, medical oncologist and hematologist with the START Center for Cancer Care in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this effort has been the culmination of work over several years, and it really goes to the idea that we need to change the landscape for practicing oncologists and develop a pathway for people who want to enter the profession to really move this profession forward and adequately treat a diverse patient population. It's likely that lack of diversity contributes to health disparities. We think that healthcare providers that are culturally competent probably deliver better care to diverse populations. But this takes plenty of work. It's not as easy as, yes, we want more oncologists, everyone sign up. This statement really serves as a blueprint to move people into the field. I guess first to address, sort of, Karen, what are your thoughts about why it's been so difficult to draw underrepresented minorities into this particular field, one that is rapidly changing and one in which only 2% of practicing oncologists identify as African American or Hispanic?
So first of all, thank you so much for kind of having this discussion. It is so important. And as you've mentioned, the ASCO statement is really a first step. There's still a lot of work to do. And frankly, a lot of what we find just in oncology care in general is that oftentimes medical students are exposed to oncology as a subspecialty late in their training. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there may be individuals, particularly those from backgrounds that are traditionally underrepresented in medicine, maybe at institutions where they may have no exposure to oncology. And so how then do you enrich a pool of applicants into a field that they may not get exposure to? And I think that's one of the challenges. We understand that there certainly is a decreased or interest in some subspecialties because of fear of complexity and fear of what it means to be an oncologist and fear of death. And frankly, I find oncology to be one of the most rewarding things ever. You know, we get to interact with patients at such a vulnerable time. And unfortunately, I think the way that oncology curricula is, oftentimes medical students are exposed when patients are in-house, right, in the hospital, when patients are very sick. They don't get to see the relationships mm-hmm. that we get to build with our amazing patients. So there may be some need for curriculum redesign, but also in finding the students from these populations that are traditionally underrepresented in medicine by maybe going to institutions that may not have oncology training programs and exposing these young students to oncology early in their careers.
Right. So absolutely, I think exposure is huge, but how do we go from exposure to really drawing people in and to showing them a path forward?
Thank you for the opportunity to be in here. I think that is a complex problem. It's not going to be solved with just one approach. I think exposure is very important because if you don't see anybody doing that, you cannot see yourself doing it. But it's also, there are economic barriers. People look for maybe careers that they could do faster and start earning earlier instead of going to another subspecialty within medicine. And you also have role models, people that you see enjoying or taking care of patients, and you see yourself in that person. They asked me why I become an oncologist, and it was one professor in particular that I saw him, the interaction with the patients, the way that he treated the patient, the way that patient treated him back, and it made me think, okay, well, you know, that's not everybody's dying, not everybody's suffering. It's something that people get a reward for. So I think that it's a complex problem. It's not going to be solved that easy. But I think recognizing that there is a problem is the first step.
So certainly we can have exposure, we can increase sort of mentorship and show that oncologists are very human too, and you know can fill those roles. But I think one thing that, at least from a personal experience on many levels, sometimes you may be the only person in a room that sort of looks like you do, or maybe has a reaction to some sort of cultural prompt or something. Yes. Mm-hmm. So what about that piece? I mean, really, how do we make a workforce that's inclusive and that we say, you know, this is, every person who goes into this field maybe is not the first one in this field. How yes. do you develop really sort of a larger sisterhood and brotherhood of people that are like-minded?
Yeah. So, you know, coming from someone who was the first Black radiation oncologist hired at my previous institution, there's a lot in what you're saying, mm-hmm. right? Being the first has many challenges, including folks perhaps underestimating your abilities, not really creating an inclusive environment. And it's not just about diversity. You cannot diversify the workforce without creating the inclusive environment. Folks need to feel welcome. They need to feel a part of a community. And so that is a broader conversation as well. But I must say that an important thing is making sure we have diversity at the faculty level, so in academia. So yes, private practice is important, and we need to make sure that we have practitioners there. But frankly, as a resident coming through, when you don't have anybody who looks like you, and it's the same thing with women, right? This is not just about racial and ethnic, you know, backgrounds, but for women, it can be a challenge not having someone who looks like you or someone that you feel like you can talk with. And from a patient perspective, it makes a difference as well, right? I treat breast cancer, and having a woman that women can talk to really helps. And similarly, we know that having a racial concordance between a provider and a patient, not only does it improve their well-being and how comfortable they feel in that setting, but we know that it improves outcomes. And so it's really important to start kind of thinking about how do we best meet the needs of that patient population.
Yes, I was thinking when you were talking about faculty, and sometimes it just takes somebody like you to be the first one, and then after that they will recognize and will be looking for other people. There is an undisclosed bias that, you know, maybe you don't know as much or maybe you're not as good. And then when they see you do something or see you talk or see you treat your patient, they realize, oh, you know, I could open. And for myself, when I came to Texas, to San Antonio, to the program, I was the first Puerto Rican. And after me, they actually got 10 other fellows through the years from the same program I came, because they realized, okay, well, you know, they are well-trained and they could work out here. But it took one person to go there, and then they opened their doors. So I think that is always so. People like you that could start that is very important. We all have to be the first doing something.
One piece I think that that certainly has been talked about a lot in the profession is this thing about imposter syndrome, right? That you sort of walk in and feel that perhaps you're the only one who doesn't still remember every part of the Krebs cycle, or, you know, that, oh, I've forgotten what that, the molecular structure of a particular chemotherapy compound, and then you realize almost everyone's in the same boat. Yeah. But I think particularly when you look different or sound different or have a different cultural experience, maybe that's even heightened. Mm-hmm. And that piece of feeling that you have to prepare twice as much,
yes,
be twice as good in
yes
anything that you
yes
say, is it's a pressure cooker.
Yes.
You know, it's a lot. And then being able to have a statement like this saying, we understand yes that your circumstances are special, may be impactful, or I hope is impactful.
Yeah.
Is there thoughts about that? Or
no, I think that that is very important. But I think as new generations come, I think for them it's going to be easier. I talk to my kids, and I see my kids had very diverse friends, you know, from all over, not only from the States. They had people from other countries, and they are their friends. And for them, they see themselves all the same. So there is not, I think growing up, we had more divisions, or, you know, more people had like preconceived ideas and things. And I think kids growing up, the new generation, they don't have the same ideas. I think it's going to be easier for them. But we still had people in the leadership positions that have to recognize that. Because ASCO as an organization, you know, the people that are in leadership are older people. Like, you know, we are older already. So we have to, we have to let them come up. And I think when they come up, it's going to be easier for them.
I hope that's the case. I mean, we see, though, even with, you know, what's going on in our country, how there's still so much division.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so there are folks who have, I think, for a long time, that older generation has in some ways suppressed mm-hmm what they felt. And so even though you can still feel it. And I want to get back to this imposter syndrome, because it's real.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm,
you think about, I really do sometimes feel like I have to work twice as hard, even at my stage. But one of the important things that I've really come to value and try to instill in any of my mentees, and I hoard mentees, right? So come to me, right?
I think so they're drawn to you.
I
don't think you're...
I love it. But I think one of the important things is, what do I have that special that I bring to the table?
Right.
The fact that as a black woman, when I walk into a room and I see a black patient sitting there and they go, are you the doctor? And they get so excited, right? It changes the dynamic instantly. And I actually can pick up on some of the social cues that maybe other folks won't. And so that is a special talent. It's a special privilege that we have when we come from backgrounds that are similar to some of our patients that, you know, frankly, my white counterparts won't be able to have that in the same way.
Right.
And that in and of itself is one of the things that allows you to build that rapport and allows patients to be more comfortable with the treatments that they're being offered and then be more willing to engage in the treatment process.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's, so what is perceived as maybe a weakness ends up being a significant strength,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's really yeah sort of a tool to work with. Do you, have you yourselves been sort of, you know, in, when you look back at your career, did you ever feel that there were particular hurdles that you had to overcome or any systematic issues that you said, listen, if this had been 15 years later and we all hope for sort of a post-racial mm-hmm society, I don't think we're going to be there yeah unless we keep working really
sure
hard. But are there things that maybe should have played out differently or that have changed how you approach the people that you're mentoring or the advice that you're giving?
So let me just start with, you know, I was the first person in my family to go to college. And a couple of my mentees who are much younger than me, one gentleman in particular that I was the first male in his family to graduate from high school.
Wow.
So understanding the social context and understand that we are not post-racial and understand that wealth actually is what we need to figure out how to get that wealth divide under control. There's a huge wealth gap based on race and ethnicity, and that impacts education. So there are so many talented individuals who are in situations where they're not getting the basics, you know, right? And so I grew up, I was fortunate enough to be in a school system that was actually very proactive, but then there's family pressures. So when I went to college, my family wasn't happy about that. And so you feel these pressures, oh, you think you're too good. And it's like,
right,
no, that's not it. I really just want to do something, you know, like
I just want to help
people. Right? And so there are these constraints. And again, having someone who's been through that, when people find out that I'm the first person to go to college, because I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, I It took 9 years for me to get finished with college.
I said, you did pretty well.
You know, I'm just saying. But still, I mean, it took me a long time because I loved everything and it was all new.
Right.
And so you kind of get there. And so then how do you focus and finding the right mentors along the way? Those are things that I kind of stumbled through. But now I can use that experience to help me in my mentoring with others.
Right, so that sort of focus, I mean, sort of that acculturation of how to do it, right, to navigate the system. And that's, I think, a huge piece, that if you don't have anyone that you can bounce ideas off of what should I be applying for, what experience should I strive for, then it's really, you are at a disadvantage.
Yes.
And there's way too much talent that is not coming to our patients and isn't changing what we need here.
Yes, we need more practitioners. We need more oncologists. We know there is a workforce shortage. So, and the population is changing. It's a diverse population. So we need to really focus on trying to bring in some additional people to the program. And, you know, I was talking to somebody earlier and says, you know, sometimes I had a patient and their kids are with them. And I asked them, you know, what you are doing. And they're in college and all that. And it's like, oh, what are you looking for? And sometimes they say, well, you know, maybe nursing or something. I says, well, is that what you want to really do? I said, well, I would like to be a doctor, but, you know, I don't know if I can. And usually I says, yes, you can. If you want to do it, you can. And, you know, we're here. We, you know, you need help. Let me know is something, because they don't see themselves being able to go on because nobody else in their family had gone to college, and a lot of time they're shorthand themselves. So it's important to promote that, to say you could do it.
Right.
Yes.
You brought up a good point, though, about the fact that there is a global shortage of oncologists, and ASCO kind of has stated that in their cancer care, you know, and I think one of the things is that we know that since there is this pipeline issue, if you will, in terms of underrepresented, you know, the folks who are from backgrounds that are traditionally underrepresented in medicine, that it's not going to be fixed. This problem of having a diverse workforce is not going to be fixed overnight. But it reminds me of that paper, and I know I'm going to jack up this name, but it, like Saha that came out in JAMA many years ago, it was 1999, I believe, which actually talked about the importance of having diversity in medical school classrooms,
right?
Because it helped to acculturate others next to you, right?
Yes.
So if there's diversity in the medical school classes, and if there's diversity in the oncology training, you know, programs, and if there's some diversity in faculty, it can actually help, because then others may say, you know, I had this patient who came in and, you know, they said they weren't interested in getting care and this and this. And I said, well, you know, did you ask X, Y, and Z, right?
Yeah.
But if they're not from an impoverished background, like myself, I mean, I was on welfare, if they don't understand the social context that people come from, they might not be asking the right questions. And we can help them simply by being present and being a colleague.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So what else can we do to sort of move that needle now? One is certainly get out there and tell our stories, I think, right? And talk to our colleagues about lending a hand up, being present, reaching out to medical students, doing some community outreach.
Yes.
And also, volunteering in for ASCO Society. I've seen volunteering to work on the committees.
So that's a huge piece, right? So owning up to leadership, right?
Because if you see somebody who is volunteering and being a leader, then that will bring other people underneath them.
Yes.
To look at do the same thing.
And in the past, there have been, you know, ASCO members who have tried to volunteer, but, you know, there's limited spaces. But now there's a volunteer corps, which we'll hear a lot more about. And so it really broadens the the exposure and the capacity to actually volunteer. But your issue about doing the community engagement, now, you know, I'm a community engagement person, so it's vital. And I think even at the state society level, making sure that the state societies are looking around and saying, okay, where is it that I can have the best and the most impact? And maybe even finding colleges or, you know, that you can go and give talks. It doesn't have to be anything formal. It can just be a, you know, a job talk or whatever it is about what do I do as an oncologist. Those early exposures are critical, because ASCO as an institution, as an organization, is not going to be able to reach back, you know, to, you know, kindergarten. But we can actually impact at local levels, and then that impact can go even further beyond that. So it's part of it is using this snowball approach in terms of community engagement.
And I think that at the local level, there's all these programs now for the STEM, for minorities, for, you know, kids in general, women. So I think that volunteering for those and talking about oncology, because otherwise you had the engineering and other careers talking to them, so they could see themselves as doing something different and something that is exciting and could help a lot of people.
Yeah, right. That's great.
Thank you so much, both Karen and Gladys. I think this has been a great conversation. Hopefully it'll spark a lot of excitement and ideas about next steps we can take. Thank you for joining us today. This is Jyoti Patel reporting from ASCO 2017.